The following content has been provided by New St. Andrews College in Moscow, Idaho. For more information, visit us online at www.nsa.edu.
Okay, Chapter 4 of the Westminster Confession of Creation. Paragraph 1. It pleased God the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost for the manifestation of the glory of his eternal power, wisdom, and goodness in the beginning to create or make of nothing the world and all things therein, whether visible or invisible, in the space of 6 days, and all very good. So let's just walk through this very straightforward. What did God make? God made everything. When did he do this? He did this in the beginning over the course of 6 days. And these should be understood naturally as 6 ordinary days, 6 24-hour days. That's the most straightforward way of reading Genesis, that's the most straightforward way of reading the confession. 6 ordinary days, 6 24-hour days. Where did God create? The answer to this is everywhere. If there's a place, then God created that place. If there's something in it, God created what's in it and what is there to contain it. The answer is everywhere. The reason he did this was to manifest his eternal power, wisdom, and goodness. And of course, that his eternal power, wisdom, and goodness was already manifest to him. He already knew about it. So what he's doing is he's manifesting his wisdom, goodness, and power to us, those of us who were created. How was all this accomplished? Well, the answer to that is we don't know. Beats us. How could we know something like that? If I knew how God created stuff from nothing, I would be a good deal richer than I currently am. So no creature can know the inscrutable nature of his divine creative power. Who is the creator God? The triune God is the one who has made all things. So that's sort of an introduction to basic theology 101. In the beginning, God created. That's a cornerstone. That's a foundation stone. Paragraph 2. After God had made all other creatures, he created man, male and female, with reasonable and immortal souls, endued with knowledge, righteousness, and true holiness, after his own image, having the law of God written in their hearts, and power to fulfill it, and yet, under a possibility of transgressing, being left to the liberty of their own will, which was subject unto change. Beside this law written in their hearts, they received a command not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, which, while they kept, they were happy in their communion with God and had dominion over the creatures. So, mankind is created in two kinds. Mankind comes in two kinds, male and female. And male and female together constitute mankind. Man alone, a standalone bachelor, does not constitute mankind. He is the federal head of mankind, but he is not by himself mankind. Without women, and this is another way of putting this, is that without women, mankind does not exist. Male and female, it says, created he them. So male and female together constitute the image of God. Male and female together constitute the race of mankind, which incidentally has relevance, which I should mention here, to our current debates over what I call same-sex mirage. It's not same-sex marriage. There is no such thing as a same-sex marriage. That's like talking about a four-sided triangle. There's no such thing as a four-sided triangle. There's no such thing as a same-sex marriage. It just doesn't exist. It's worth pointing out that the attempt to make it exist is a way of declaring war on the image of God. If God creates mankind in his own image, male and female created he them in his own image, then to say that male and female is optional to marriage is to say that we don't like how God did it. So we were created, it says, with reasonable souls, destined for life beyond this life. We have a contingent immortality, not an essential immortality. It's a contingent immortality, not an essential immortality. It's the gift of God, in other words. What do I mean by that? God gives us the gift of life, and our immortal souls have this life ordinarily by possession of a physical body. Christians do not hold to a doctrine of the immortality of the soul, but rather to the doctrine of the resurrection of the dead. So, there was a Socrates, for example, believed in the immortality of the soul. The immortality of the soul believes that there's something about the human soul that is essentially immortal. Christians believe that we will in fact live forever, but that's the gift of God. God need not have done it that way. God could have created a creature to worship and adore him for 10 years or 10 minutes, and then the gift could cease to be. That's not inconsistent. That'd be 10 minutes or 10 years more than the creature who was nothing had before. So when God gives us immortality, he's giving us a gift. It's not something that we have sort of as a birthright, or it's not something that's essential to what we are. So Christians believe in the immortality of the soul because we believe in the resurrection of the dead, resurrection of the body, and we believe that immortality is a contingent gift. It is ours because of God's grace to us. It's not ours because of the nature of the soul. The Bible tells us in the Old Testament that we bear the imago Dei, the image of God. But in the New Testament, we find a description of this image in Ephesians, knowledge, righteousness, and holiness. The Bible does not define the image of God as reason. Angels are reasonable creatures and do not bear the image of God. Handicapped humans might not be able to reason well, and yet they bear the image of God. So someone who's severely handicapped might be a human being, severely handicapped, and not as mentally equipped as the household dog. The dog might be better able to navigate and figure things out and respond and interact, but the dog is not created in the image of God, and the handicapped human is. It's not reason. So what is the image? We have a true sense of right and wrong built in, God having written his law on the heart. It is knowledge, righteousness, and true holiness. Because it is sinful, this image has been marred, and so we have to grow back up into that image as we grow up into Jesus Christ. Our ability to be in union with Jesus is the image of God. The fact that we can be united with Christ is we had that upgradable capacity from the beginning. So that is the image of God. That was the image that was defaced or marred. When we were created, we had the true possibility of obedience, meaning that nothing in our nature hindered us in obeying. At the same time, being in a state of probationary innocence, we had the possibility of disobeying. In addition to an innate sense of right and wrong, God had also commanded us to refrain from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Until we disobeyed him in this, we were content in our fellowship with God, and we had dominion over the beasts of the earth.
New St. Andrew's College thanks you for listening.